listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, June is National Indigenous History Month in Canada, and we celebrated National Indigenous Peoples Day on June 21st. We will, of course, follow some of the stories covered by our journalist from across the country and make some stops in Smithers, British Columbia, Edmonton, Alberta, and Kitchener and Cobourg, Ontario.
There is a real genuine willingness to learn. There is a much stronger willingness on the part of the general population to understand facets of our history.
And we catch up with former Much Music VJ and Canadian television personality Michael Williams, who recently hosted the second Slocan City International Music and Art Fair in BC.
It was the most magical, wonderful journey, an incredible place to be in Slocan. Beautiful little place, great people.
Two historical buildings in Ontario will have a new vocation, an old schoolhouse on the lake, and another in downtown Peterborough.
I mean, it's a real pocket that's so dense with talent. So we're hoping to kind of shine a light on that a little bit.
And the in-house experience in Waterloo, Ontario, where some 50 people pitched their tents for 24 hours in the park in support of the in-house people in the region.
For the most part, we're here to spread awareness and hopefully make the homeless issue visible enough that people can't continue ignoring it.
You're tuned into Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So welcome, nice to have you with us. All the best to those who are affected by the forest fires across Canada and to First Nation and Métis communities who are celebrating their culture this month. To cover the events, our first stop will take us to Edmonton and to the first official Okisakawe Day. On June 14, community members gathered along 100A Avenue to commemorate the street's history of gender-based violence. This year, they also inaugurated a new crosswalk, which was unveiled on the street, painted by Edmonton artist Nick Goodswimmer. The new crosswalk on Okisakawe is located alongside the new street blades designed by the late Gloria Nepetung. She was an artist, social activist, street survivor, sister, and member of Yellow Quill First Nation in Saskatchewan. Gloria represents the community of survivors that Okisakawe is meant for. She was a victim herself, passing away in 2016. Ryan Hunt is in Edmonton, Alberta. He spoke with April Eve Weiberg, founder of the Stolen Sisters and Brothers Action Movement, about the history of the road.
On a gray, rainy afternoon in Edmonton, community members gathered on Okisakawe in between 96th and 97th Street Northwest to remember those who were victims of gender-based violence in the past and how to help those in the future. April Eve Weiberg, the founder of the Stolen Sisters and Brothers Action Movement, spoke about what happened on the afternoon of June 14th.
Today is Edmonton's Okisakawe Day, and we're here today to deliver an annual proclamation from the city of Edmonton establishing June 14th as Okisakawe Day.
Okisakawe has been in the city for a long time and stemmed from a national movement that started in 2007. Weiberg talks about the history behind the street name and why it has its name.
12 years ago, we first launched the first Angel Way in Edmonton with a number of other grassroots community leaders. The initiative first started in Iqaluit, Nunavut, and in 2011, Edmonton became the fifth city in the country to have its own Angel Way. We chose as a community to give it an Indigenous name, so Okisakau means angel in Cree, and it's a multicultural grassroots movement to help end gender-based violence and offer and demonstrate support to the survivors, those that didn't survive, and their families.
Weiberg says that the movement means a lot to her because of personal connections she has with the street.
My sister in spirit, Gloria Nepetung, she was the artist who designed the angel on the sign blade. Gloria passed away a number of years ago. I'm just really moved by the amount of support that this initiative is receiving. There is a long-term vision for Okeosakau Way. Some of that may include a mural of Gloria. Gloria represents the community of survivors that Okeosakau Way is meant for, because she was someone that was a victim of child abuse, child sexual exploitation, domestic abuse, and so on. It's an honor that I was asked by her family to deliver some words on behalf of her sister, Sherry Campio, and they're from the Yellow Quill First Nation Treaty 4 in Saskatchewan. Gloria and I had a lot of similarities when we had first met before we started doing this work together, both from Saskatchewan, a lot of the same type of upbringing. I feel Gloria's spirit here with us today, and it's just a real honor to be a part of this over and over again.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
Hi, I'm Alex Wright in Prince Edward County, Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
National Indigenous Peoples Day recognizes and celebrates the history, heritage, resilience, and diversity of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people across Canada, and attitudes are slowly changing towards First Nation communities, says Alderville First Nation Chief Dave Mowat. Alderville First Nation is located north of Cobourg, Ontario, on the north side of Lake Ontario. While challenges still remain, Chief Mowat says he believes the public is more open to learning about First Nations history. Mowat said he's seen the education process grow. But Mowat also said it's not about one day or one month. Chief Mowat underlines that treaties are what built this country. And in his interview with journalist Jeff Gard in Cobourg, he talks specifically about one of them, the Williams Treaty First Nations Settlement Agreement. Here's an excerpt of their conversation about the impact of the Williams Treaty settled in 2018 and also on the shift in attitudes towards First Nations people.
Well, the Williams Treaty's claim, it took 26 years from beginning to end,
right,
through a number of things, you know, change in governments, you name it. We eventually went to trial in 2013. It was negotiated between 2016 and 18. So all told, it took 26 years. We certainly hope some of the other claims won't take that long. You just have to have patience and be prepared to spend years on these.
Like, what did the Williams Treaty settlement mean to, say, Alderville and these potential ones? Like, when you're doing them, what does it mean to your members?
It might mean a variety of things to the members, but from a governance perspective and from chief and or council perspective, mm-hmm. it's about not only the present but the future. We are able to put a sizable amount in trust. And through that trust mechanism, we are able to fund a number of internal community projects. Everything from infrastructure projects to new programming to creating new benefits for our membership. So I see the benefits, not only were there short-term benefits, but having a sizable amount in trust means that we can look out over the long term as well, to provide for those certain things like medical, recreation. We even have a funeral fund, actually. But on the infrastructure side, I was just talking to one of our elders earlier. I was over to visit, and I was talking about the trust that we have and what we were able to do over the last 3 years or so regarding our infrastructure. And if we had to grovel to the government for certain projects that we did on our own, we'd still be waiting. So that's the beauty of having your own internal sort of financial machine, is you're able to meet the short term and also look long term at the same time.
So this is National Indigenous History Month, and Wednesday is National Indigenous Peoples Day. For those outside of Alderville who really want to support, like, what's the best way people can support?
Well, being a historian and, you know, looking at the community through that lens, I think it's important for people to seek out credible sources to teach themselves or to learn about some of the issues related to treaty. Treaty is what built the country. It was through the treaty process that Canada was able to become what it is, and it's a troubled history. And so it would benefit any and all people to learn about the treaty process and where it's rooted, it's not dusty old history because it's still playing out to this day. And so that's the word, that's how I always approach it, is through education and through, you know, wanting to learn. We have our challenges with the school curriculum, and, you know, we have challenges with government even. There's a mindset there that still is unaccepting of our history and our place in this country. And so it's through education that I always point people towards to gain better insight as to some of the challenges as where some of these claims come from. We just don't dream up these things. You know, they come from a credible source, and they come from a history of the community that was maybe unresolved in certain cases. So I always impress upon people that education and knowledge is the best resource you can have when it comes to learning about First Nations communities and First Nations people and First Nations history.
With more conversation over the last few years, a similar question to before, but do you feel progress is being made?
I think generally on the ground, there's a lot of interest in First Nations communities. I make a fair number of presentations to various groups, and there is a real genuine willingness to learn. You're always going to have people that don't agree or, you know, who don't care, and that's just the way it is. That's human nature. But from my experience, there is a much stronger willingness on the part of the general population to understand facets of our history.
Chief Mowat says he gives presentations throughout the year. He said he's always happy to discuss First Nations history. He was speaking to Jeff Gard in Cobourg, Ontario. The Solidarity Unity Jam and Lacrosse game was held in Waterloo Park on June 21st. Taking place on the summer solstice, the Waterloo event seeks to celebrate solidarity and unity in honoring the Grand River, upholding Haudenosaunee rights and land stewardship in the Haldimand Tract, in which the Waterloo region was built. Based in Kitchener, Ontario, journalist Dan Keller spoke with Courtney Sky, Protect the Tract organizer, about the Solidarity Day, the work of Protect the Tract, and the importance of honoring the treaty relationships, which were a basis of sharing the land between settlers, the Haudenosaunee, and other Indigenous nations.
Unity Jam is a lot of Indigenous artists coming together to be in solidarity with one another through our acts of resistance and celebration and making music and hanging out and just having a good time with one another. Just excited about the day and hanging out with musicians and hanging out with friends and seeing people and visiting. It's always a really inviting time and meeting new people. So very excited to have this event take place in Waterloo.
How does the Unity Jam further the work of Protect the Track?
Well, we want to invite many people into a conversation around the future of the Grand River watershed and to have conversations around what does our future along the Grand River look like. The moratorium and development was put in place following a lot of the conflict that was happening at 1492 Lamback Lane between land defenders and OPP, where we're seeing a lot of criminalization, a lot of violence happening. And our traditional leadership said, you know, in order for us to actually have a meaningful conversation, a meaningful dialogue, to be able to have the nation-to-nation conversations, we need to stop having our land be developed without our consent and without, you know, consideration for what's happening in the future. In order to have really meaningful conversation around climate change, around the future of how we're caring for the river, all these things can't happen while there is a while land keeps getting developed. So that's the reason for the moratorium. It's to shift the conversation that's been happening between Indigenous people, between Hood and Shoshone people, and the people that share the Grand River watershed with us, that we are having a more respectful conversation around how we're stewarding the lands, because I think everyone that lives along the Grand River recognizes it's not flourishing, it's not able to sustain the people that live along it in a really healthy way. So we want to have a conversation about it, but then we also recognize that this is a treaty-based relationship, and our original agreements and treaties don't talk about us being in conflict or fighting with one another. They talk about us being in partnership and friendship with one another. And that doesn't mean that we always have to be in conflict, but we can have friends and relationships and invite people into a meaningful conversation that's respectful, but it can also be fun and friendly.
Thanks to our new team member, Dan Keller. And to celebrate National Indigenous Peoples Day, our BC journalists took a look at some of the best Indigenous stories they've covered across Northwest BC this year and presented four great items, stories by Pamela Hassan, Morgan Button, and Danielle Masek. The first is set in Northwest BC, where the 63rd All-Native Prince Rupert Basketball Tournament was held, featuring Indigenous basketball teams from across British Columbia and beyond. The second story explores the struggle of Indigenous rights in Northwest BC and a year-long conflict between the Wet'suwet Nation and the Coastal GasLink pipeline project. The repatriation of a Nisga totem pole and how the community is celebrating its return is a glimmer of hope for the future of stolen items being returned to Indigenous nations. And our journalists go to Haida Gwaii, where the renaming of a municipality in the northern archipelago will go back to its traditional name, Daijingeeds. So as you can see, lots of diverse, beautiful, and meaningful stories covered by a journalist out west and across the country. Please tune in to canada-info.ca and dig into our rich local news and national history.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosnay in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
Next, we stay out west in the company of Scott Onishak in Kootenay, BC, who met up with longtime Canadian television personality Michael Williams, who recently hosted the second Slocan City International Music and Art Fair. The two-day event, which ran from June 16 to 17, featured the J.C. Smith Band, Henry Brown, and Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, among others. For Williams, the fair experience in the Kootenays was memorable. Throughout his career, Williams has interviewed several famous musicians and groups, including Tina Turner, Lou Reed, and Run DMC. He spoke with journalist Scott Onishak.
From 1984 to 1993, Michael Williams was a popular video jockey for the newly created Much Music. This past weekend, he traveled to Slocan to host the Slocan Music and Arts Fair. This was the second year of the festival. It contains live music from local and international acts, as well as art showcases, workshops, and other events. Williams spoke highly of his time in the Kootenays.
It was the most magical, wonderful journey and incredible place to be in Slocan. Beautiful little place, great people. And they did this festival, a music festival, and I loved it. And I just felt like it was a magical place and met people from all over the world in Slocan. And I asked them, what is it about Slocan? They say they don't know, but it always brings them back.
This year's version of the festival featured the J.C. Smith Band, Henry Brown, Kenny Blues Boss Wayne, and plenty of local talent. One goal of the festival was to introduce artists and audiences to the wonders of the Slocan Valley and its community. Based on the comments from Williams, they seem to have accomplished that.
Thanks to Scott Onishak. On Friday, May 26, a month after the city of Kitchener, Ontario, closed public access to Roos Island in their effort to relocate people who had been living in an encampment on the island, a demonstration was held to remind the public that though the tents are gone, the housing crisis is not. And in response to those evictions, the Unhoused Experience 24-hour challenge invited people to pitch tents for 24 hours in Victoria Park in Kitchener, Ontario. Despite a heavy presence of bylaw and security, around 50 people answered the call and participated in workshops and listened to advocates and people who have experience being unhoused to tell their stories. Patricia Holmes talked to a few of them in this excerpt of her 20-minute documentary. Here she is on location in Kitchener, Ontario.
My name is Kyle Wall. I'm a musician and activist that's lived in Kitchener for most of my life. And I'm here because I've long been an advocate for
unhoused people and affordable housing, but recently I became unhoused myself, so now I also have real-world experience that gives me a perspective I'd like to share with people. Tonight we're doing a 24-hour challenge where the original idea was to challenge people to live like the unhoused do with us for a night here, just to sort of spread awareness. And for the most part, we're here to spread awareness and hopefully make the homeless issue visible enough that people can't continue ignoring it.
My name is Jack Spicer-Forler, and I'm 18. I'm here to join the protest for the encampment in support of the encampment and community members facing homelessness in the region. I was unhoused for a minimal amount of time when I was 12 years old. At that point, I was sleeping at bus stops and couch surfing at my friends' houses.
And you were talking about how there's a lot of children who are unhoused.
Yes.
And that it's common around 12 to be unhoused.
Yes. I did have a lot of friends, especially back then, who were around my age and also going through homelessness and being in shelters and couch surfing and landing in unsafe situations and things like that. Most of them were around 12 or 13, around the time that they were doing this. Right.
And so what happens with your schooling or anything like that? It just doesn't happen.
Education is, like, next to impossible without access to busing, without access to shelter. You know, if you don't have clean clothes or water or anything like that, you know, how are you supposed to be prepared to get an education? So if you don't have any of those resources, you can't get an education. You have to, you know, completely focus on survival.
At 12, 13.
Right, yeah. Which is crazy.
And then exposed to violence probably as well.
Absolutely. I had many friends who were going into shelters and other encampments, and they were dealing with sexual trauma and domestic violence and encounters with authority figures who would inflict violence onto them.
Visit Canada.ca for Patricia's full story. An old school in Bellwood, Ontario, built in the late 1800s, has a busy summer ahead. The school, known as the Skull House, will be kicking off its 10 concert series in the coming weeks. But the historic spot future remains undecided. Skull House co-owners Noah Clark and Jefferson Wild are now welcoming feedback from community members to determine part of its future. More on this with Ryan Gillespie-Wilson in Fergus, Ontario.
The property on 24 North Broadway Street in Bellwood is a magic spot, a stone's throw away from the lake, according to co-owner Noah Clark. The Skull House, as it's known, will be hosting a series of 10 concerts this summer starting on Canada Day. That's the temporary use for the property. But as construction continues at the 1800 schoolhouse, co-owner Noah Clark says its long-term purpose will be determined in part by the community.
We know the use. We want people to enjoy this space. So that's sort of our end goal. We want to bring people back to this space. How exactly we do that, we're very open to feedback from the people that are going to be using the space. That's sort of our approach.
The concerts starting in July remind Clark the Fergus area is home to some incredible musicians.
What we hope to do at the schoolhouse this year and next year is really put a spotlight on the fantastic talent that exists around here, and especially in the Allura Fergus area. I mean, it's a real pocket that's so dense with talent, so we're hoping to kind of shine a light on that a little bit.
Right now, the building is in the early stage of planned engineering. It's a complicated project, he says, as the building has been abandoned for so long. Clark says the plan, however, is not to wait years before opening the doors to the community. I'm Riley Gillespie-Wilson.
Another historic building is up for grabs, but this time it's in Peterborough, Ontario. The future of the Queen Alexandra Community Centre is being explored by the Peterborough City Council. Demolition could be on the table for the historic building. The council recommended that a feasibility study be conducted to determine the appropriate redevelopment of the property. But the study is expected to conclude that the building is to be demolished and replaced by a multi-residential apartment building for seniors, with a seniors activity center on the ground floor. Some councillors raise concerns about the heritage status of the Queen Alexandra Community Center. Here's Edward Sweeney with that story.
At the Peterborough City Council's General Committee meeting on June 12th, they discussed a report focusing on the potential redevelopment of the Queen Alexandra Community Center. The Queen Alexandra Community Center is located at 180 Bernardo Avenue. It was built as a school in 1890, and classes stopped being held at the school in 1973. The building and the property were purchased by the city from the public school board in 1976, and since then, it has been used as a community center and is currently being used by Activity Haven Senior Center. The primary purpose of this report is to approve the funding required to conduct a feasibility study on the redevelopment of this property. If conducted, the study would provide direction in the redevelopment of Queen Alexandra into a multi-residential apartment building for seniors, along with a seniors' activity center located on the ground floor. The report recommends that up to $60,000 from the Community Development Program Reserve be used to finance the cost of this feasibility study, and the full budget of the redevelopment will be determined as part of this study. Councillor Alex Burke shared a concern about the report. He feels that there should be a greater effort to conduct adaptive reuse on the property before committing to the demolition of a historic building.
You know, and I drive here to these council meetings once a week, and I come to City Hall, and I look at what a beautiful job they did at the YMCA, that adaptive reuse. And I look at the adaptive reuse that they've done at buildings like the J.J. Turner Building. And so I just struggle to support this without that adaptive reuse option.
Community Services Commissioner Sheldon Laidman recognizes that heritage is a significant concern of the city, but it must be balanced with other priorities. In answering Councillor Burke's questions, he says that the study would explore all options for redevelopment.
What's being approved, you are correct that it's an expected that it would be demolished, but there is a feasibility, council's approving the feasibility study at this point in time. As part of that feasibility study, it would certainly be looking at the cost of demolition, whether the building could be saved in terms of how the site might be laid out.
Councillor Joy LaChica also voiced concern about the heritage status of this property. Councillor LaChica feels that this report may be premature as they have not yet consulted the Peterborough Architectural Conservation Advisory Committee, or PACAC.
Could there be another way to preserve this without demolition being at the forefront and coming to us ahead of anything else as a probability? Because that's the feeling I'm getting from the report, that this is probably the best choice, and that's what we're leading with. And instead, should we be leading with, let's go to PACAC, and let's not rush into any of this when we have a heritage building in a significant heritage area.
Councillor LaChica also believes that the report should include more information about the financial cost and the carbon footprint of a demolition. Councillors Leslie Parnell and Kevin Duguay both voiced their support of the recommendations in the report, recognizing that, though it is a historic building, the positives of a redevelopment outweigh the negatives. Duguay, as someone who currently uses the Activity Haven Community Center, calls the building difficult to move around in and questions whether or not it could possibly meet the accessibility standards required for adaptive reuse. Councillor Duguay agrees with Councillor LaChica in that it is important to consult PACAC before any decisions are made, but still supports going forward with the feasibility study.
And this may be an opportunity to improve a community-serving facility and introduce much-needed housing, potentially aimed at our older adult population.
Council went ahead to vote on the recommendations in the report, and the vote was carried. Council has approved the funding for the feasibility study on the redevelopment of the Queen Alexandra Community Center. This has been Eddie Sweeney, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative here in Peterborough, Ontario.
And this closes this edition of Viewpoints. Our reporters this week were Ryan Hunt, Patricia Holmes, Jeff Gard, Ryan Gillespie-Wilson, Dan Keller, Danielle Masek, Pamela Hassan, Edward Sweeney, and Scott Onishchuk. National editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and broadcast through your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Hassan. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.